Accession number 29077, Reel 5.
Herbert Bryce, Reel 5.
I was just saying, actually, that when we got into Singapore, there were loads of Japanese prisoners there, camps of them, but completely different people altogether. Not once did I have any spot of trouble with them. If you asked them to do something, they would do it, there was never any. I mean, it's quite different. I mean, how you wouldn't really have thought, well, were they the people that we were trying to fight further up, and it was quite amazing, and I think all brought about by this very rigorous, forceful nature of the Japanese officer, who from higher up right down to the lower officers, I mean, they'd all treat them in the same. Anybody below is treated as you've been treated, as you see, and they would tell them what to do, and they would do it. And there was no question at all of any, you know, can't do it or it's too difficult. It would be done, and that was that. So that was interesting. Not that I was terribly involved in the Japanese prisoners, but they were good workers, and give them their credit there. But a completely different aspect in Singapore. It was purely I can't remember what we did in Singapore. When we went up to Malaya, there was a bit of trouble in Malayan jungle, but that didn't develop really until a year or two after I left. And
that trouble from the Chinese, you mean?
Yes, from the, all these communist types that was the Chinese and insurgents, wasn't it? Yes. It was a completely different aspect, and we were in a camp, and we had a bed and a house to live in and everything, and it was a complete change from what life had been for the last 3 or 4 years.
Were you able, in a position to see what life had been like in Singapore throughout the course of the war?
I think it had been pretty grim, but most of the people that had been in Singapore during the war had all been evacuated, and the only ones that were there were the Malays and a lot of Chinese, of course. All that they were really out to do was to get back to normal and start. I don't think they'd been as rigidly controlled as the white population and the Malays. I think the Japanese relied on them quite considerably for food and materials and guidance and dock areas and what was navigable and what wasn't, because they used Singapore quite extensively from their naval point of view, and there was a marvelous dry dock in Singapore in the naval base, which I think the Japanese made good use of. But I didn't come across anybody that criticised extensively how they'd been treated by the Japanese during the Japanese occupation. I've no doubt they sat on them pretty rigidly, but then they probably accepted it part of life, as they tend to.
What about contact with Commonwealth prisoners of war?
Well, they went out very quickly. We got them out on hospital ships as quickly as we possibly could, and I had one or two friends who had come out with me who'd gone into the bag, and I made contact with one of them, actually. He was in a pretty poor state, actually, very poor state, but survived. And it amazes me really how some of these chaps, the condition that they were in, how they managed to survive and afterwards. Apart from surviving during their treatment by the Japanese, which was pretty powerful, wasn't it? They got them. I don't know how any of them ever managed to exist at all, but they did. And luckily, when they came out, they were taken rapidly as possible back to civilization, where they were well looked after and brought back to normal. But they did have a tough time, those POWs, no doubt about that.
Did you have any experience of any anti-British sentiment fostered by the Japanese among the Malayan or Burmese or Indian population?
No, not at all. No. I don't think the Japanese were popular amongst the Malays or the Chinese in Singapore. I think they put up with them, but there was certainly no indication that I got that that they'd been indoctrinated. I don't, nothing at all, as far as I can recall. I think they were all glad to see the Japanese go.
How long were you in Singapore for?
Oh, only a year, actually. I got there in September, in August, was it August 45, and left in August 46, so I just had a year there. And it was, as I said, quite a pleasant change.
Did you have military duties to?
Yes, sorry. Yes. It was mostly carrying supplies and dock, clearing ships in the dock area, and taking it up into Malaya and Kuala Lumpur and places like that, and to the odd units that were in the Malay Straits, Malacca and places like that. But most of the work was around about in Singapore, on the island itself, and not terribly intensive duties either. We had plenty of free time, so that helped us to enjoy it. For instance, one of the jobs our workshop officer did, he got hold of the Japanese, they'd built thin three-plies suicide craft, which they would load up with explosives, and the chap would drive it into a ship and explode like a torpedo. And they'd built a lot of these for use against the Navy, and they were lying around in Singapore, so we picked up one, and our workshop officer put in a Jeep engine, and we used that roundabout going out to the islands and having a nice little ride around, you see, and things like that were quite helpful and pleasant. So the Japanese suicide craft wasn't used for suicide purposes on Arik, and the one that we had anyway.
And after your year in Singapore, were you returned to?
Well, I came back to England, and then I went into banking, and I had 4 months leave. Actually, I didn't go into banking until, was it 1947, I think. I made it. It took quite a while to settle back in this country, I must admit. Both my parents had died, and my brother and I, and he was busy. He he'd gone back to his job, and so I went into banking, and I got married and settled down in the banking fraternity.
Had there been any question of you staying on in the army?
Well, I could have stayed on, and I was very tempted to stay on, actually. I don't think I would have enjoyed the army staying on under peacetime rules and regulations. I got so used to the freedom of the army, that I think. But what I would have enjoyed doing, actually, but I didn't get around to it, was perhaps going into some overseas type of work, which either the fact that India got partition at that time mucked up some of the plans I had in mind, and so I didn't really. Nobody was. They didn't want you back in India, the Indian government. So everybody was virtually pushed out. I could have stayed actually, but I thought I'd come back and see what this country was like after. So I did, and that was the rest of my life, as you might say.
Before Operation Zipper, had you been aware that the war in Europe had finished?
We knew that things were going quite well, and we would get in the newspapers that the army newspaper that would send around give us details, but in actual fact, the day that war was the peace was declared in Europe, I was on leave, and I was doing a trek into Tibet. And I was actually in Tibet, at a little tiny village in Tibet, and I think they had a radio there, which someone managed to decipher was the fact that victory had been declared in Europe, and so I was actually in Europe in Tibet when victory in Europe took place, and it was another week or 10 days before I got back into civilization again.
And then at the end of August in 1945.
And 1945. Well,
when victory over Japan was declared, what was your response to that and feelings?
When they dropped the bomb, the first thing, nobody knew what an atom bomb was, and I said to our workshop officer, who was a very good engineer actually, a Scotsman, and who'd been to he seemed to know what an atom bomb was. They've exploded, but nobody knew what the repercussions would be. One might set off something else. They split the atom and this sort of thing. So that was the first one. And the second one dropped, and that was the end of it. I suppose relief in many respects, that we knew that the landing on the coast of Malaya was going to be a difficult exercise, because the Japanese were having experienced them before. They would bunker themselves in any likely places, and you'd have a job to break that down. Added to which, we didn't have the facilities over there that they had over here. The D-Day equipment that they had was, from the landing point of view, was quite tremendous. Mind you, they needed it, of course, against the Germans. But So I think we were all very thankful that that the Japanese had packed up, but there was I won't say there was any great hilarity or anything like that. It was simply, well, thank goodness for that type of thing, and off we go, and we're off down to Singapore now. It was probably a bit touch and go that if they hadn't dropped the bomb, we would have had a difficult job and many, many casualties getting onto Malaya, I'm sure of that. It's such a vast coast to get onto, and they were well spread out and well experienced, the Japanese, and they had plenty of equipment down there. After we heard the bombs dropped, we probably did find another, I can't remember what we had to drink in those days, rum, usually, that was the only drink that they provide. We did, towards the end of the war, we used to get bottles of beer, but rum was the only, we could buy a whiskey or a gin, I think once a month from the NAFI, but we did get an issue of rum. It, certainly in the monsoon, it was quite useful.
You did have access to a NAFI in?
Well, not a ready access. It would probably take you a day or so to get to one, but you did get into a NAFI. The NAFI, I suppose, came into being out in our area about the last year, when the British troops came out, the NAFI came out, and that was probably 43, in the latter part of 43, and you would get a bit, at the same time you would get entertainment shows, some of these, they would come around, and some of them were good, some of them were pretty awful actually, but they were meant for British units, and the British unit would invite us, the British officers, along to see it if we wanted to, if we were handy. And we would arrange for our own units. We would arrange, we were in Fowl, and we would arrange for dances and things for them, you know, local dancers to come and give a show for them, to entertain them for a bit, give them a break, which they enjoyed. And
did you have any contact with the Americans in Burma?
Very little. We knew where they were, and we knew what they were doing. They were in Assam, and in the northern part of India, of Assam rather, with Stillwell. But the only real American contact we had was when they lent us their planes, instead of flying their supplies from Assam into China. Matt Vatten did a wonderful job. He managed to persuade them against Roosevelt's instructions, I think, to let us have some of the planes to bring supplies into Imphal during the siege. And then we'd come across a few American pilots and people like that, but generally speaking, no, I didn't really have any contact with Americans at all. See if we got anything.
Were you in any position to make any observations about the any differences between the various troops you were in contact with, your Indian troops and the British soldiers, and how they compared.
Yes, it does. I think the British troops, I think they accepted that the Indians were good fighters, and certainly the Gurkhas they had a high respect for, but I think they tended to look down on the Indian troops generally. And I suppose it was I wouldn't think it was intentional, but it was just the way that when you're in India, you're waited upon. You have an Indian servant sort of thing, and they do the dirty work for you. And I think they rather expected to be looked after by the Indian, not have to treat him as a friend. But on the other hand, I think certainly when you're in a tight situation, and they realise that they could be a good friend, and I think did respect them. But generally speaking, the Indian and the British other rank anyway didn't mix a great deal. At least this is what I felt. And the only other ones that we had in were the Chinese. When they came out originally, they were in Burma, and Sana. One of the Chinese divisions came out through us, but they were in quite a poor state. But what happened to them? Then they went back up and joined Stillwell, and I never saw them again. So I think the Gurkha was certainly highly respected by the British, Tommy, and. Quite justifiably so, too.
Did you have any experience with them?
Yes, I had quite a bit of experience with the Gurkhas, working with them, I had some chaps in my unit from Nepal, they would be quite willing to drink quite heavily if they could get anything that they could lap up. They got a bit haywire when they'd had too much to drink, but generally I would give them all the admiration that they deserve. We would have been sadly lacking in strength out there without them. And there were dozens of battalions of Gurkha regiments, and some of them were in the Middle East too, weren't they? They did well for us. So generally speaking, I think everybody got on quite well together. You grumbled a bit as the winds. Things went wrong. We made the best of it, I think, and that was the way we survived out there.
Could you explain a bit more about the social makeup of your Indian troops?
The social makeup? They were almost entirely the sepoys, which is the ordinary soldier, was called a sepoy. He was almost entirely from an Indian villages. And in the main, they would come from villages that had provided infantry soldiers into the infantry battalions, and therefore they knew a little bit about what was meant to join the army. But as I said earlier on, they were all volunteers, and I think as a result of that. Been completely uneducated, almost all of them, they thought, well, let's go and you know, do what we can and get paid for doing it. And we tried to teach them certain simple things, like you'd expect them to write their name and this sort of thing. And eventually, they would learn, and they would pick up some of them a little bit of English too. But quite a number of them couldn't even speak the Urdu that you spoke, because they came from a village area which spoke some other language. You got very comparatively few from southern India. Now, they were better educated. The ones we would have had from southern India would have been, in the main, the educated ones who would do the clerical work. You'd have an office clerk, a havildar or sergeant. Havildar is the Indian Army equivalent to a sergeant, and he would run his office, and he would have perhaps one or two, and he would cover all your unit records. There would be the non-commissioned officers, and they were all from infantry regiments, and so that they knew the drill and everything, and all the recruits had gone through a sort of infantry training before they came into the unit. But they were, I don't know how long they were trained, perhaps 3 or 6 months at the most, I think. But the NCOs were good, and then you had another caliber above the NCOs who were called Viceroy Commissioned Officers, and they were commissions which had been given by the Viceroy of India. There was a Jemadar, a Subedar, and a Subedar Major, and they would have little pips on their shoulder which were different from the King's Commission. And they were all from the infantry regiments, and they came in to give you a link between yourselves and the the rest of the Indians, so that you had a very useful. I mean, there were only five British officers in a company, and each one had a section of about 100 men to look after, and each one would have a jemadar. And then the OC in the headquarters would have a subedar or a subedar major, you see, and they would all be very experienced and old soldiers who spoke English and knew how to deal with any problems that you might have, and he would explain to you that so and so and so and so has gone home to his village and he's miles away, so don't be too hard on him if he's late back, sort of thing. And this is the way they would put you in the picture, which is, you know, was invaluable. then as the war went on, the chaps that you came in as from their villages, and they were no longer sepoys, so they would get promoted to what would be called a lance knight and a knight, which is lance corporal and corporal, and they would go up to up to sergeant or havildar, and that's where it stopped. There was no rank above havildar or sergeant. There was no sergeant major. Then he stayed as a sergeant, and that was that. And then when they went home, they went home. And a lot of them would write to me afterwards and say, can you find me a job in England, you see? I would put them off because you'd hate the climate, and B, unless you can read and write and are fluent in it, you wouldn't get by, and then C, you really, you've got to be able to live and discuss. If you want to get a job over here, you've got to know, compete with people over here. And I mean, everybody coming out of the army were looking for jobs in those days. So I used to try to put them off. I expect some of them came, but none of them will ever come up to me and said, I was with you back in such and such a time.
Herbert Bryce, Reel 6. Did you have to make considerations towards caste or religion?
No trouble at all, but yes, we did, to the extent that if someone was killed, if a Hindu was killed, he would be burnt. If a Mohammedan was killed, he would be buried. And we had both Mohammedans and Hindus and Sikhs and Christians in our unit. So you had a pretty fair mixture, and there was never the slightest bit of trouble. The kitchen for the Hindu side, they would have their food, and the Mohammedans would have their food, generally speaking. But if there were any problems, they all ate whatever they was going, and there was, we never